It's time for our regular monthly segment, Mondays with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh joins us on the line. And with so much to cover, from police reform efforts to schools working on reopening, we want to jump right in. So what questions do you have for Mayor Marty Walsh? Call to ask at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me today.
So, Mayor Walsh, I want to start with an issue that I know is important to you. You talked about it last Thursday after a store clerk was shot in Roxbury. Then we had another tragedy over the weekend, the gut-wrenching death of two more young people due to gun violence. A 16-year-old and a 17-year-old on Sunday. Later in the evening, an 18-year-old was shot and remains in critical condition. We know that shootings are up more than 20% from this time last year. What do you think is going on?
I mean, I think it has to do with, I think coronavirus is playing into it. I think of lack of opportunities playing into it. I think that normally in other summers, we would be having full efforts out in our communities, working to create opportunities for people. By not having those this year plays into it. Not having places for people to go at night plays into it. These shootings, I spoke to a group of young people today at the Firefighters Cadet Academy. We have a teen program for firefighters, and these are all high school kids. And I was talking to them about what they've been faced with in this year alone, a pandemic, racial unrest. And I said to them that the greatest generation, were born during a pandemic, during World War I, World War II, the Civil Rights Movement, and it was spread out over 50, 60 years, and these young people are faced with it right now. So there's a lot of emotions going on. And I also expressed them this week, the last, four of the last five homicides, I believe, have been two 17-year-olds, an 18-year-old, and a 15-year-old. We haven't seen that. Oh, I haven't seen that in my time as mayor here. And, life is very fragile and very valuable. We need to all step up and do so much more to create opportunity and bring some peace to our community. I mean, I can't get into each of those cases, what happened, but it's certainly something that we're seeing happen around the country as well, which is wrong.
You said last week, quote, "We're working every day to eliminate the root causes of crime in Boston," end quote. And in hearing you just now, I find myself thinking, long-term sustained systems change is going to take a sense of urgency and frustration by all players in the face of these kinds of deaths. How do you build that sustained attention and urgency among all the players it takes to make systems change in the city? And what else do you have to do that?
I mean, part of it is explaining to young people the value of life. And what I said today to these young people, I said that I asked how many people were 15, 17, and 18, and several hands went up. And I talked to them about, if it just ended, their whole life in front of them, they have dreams and hopes that they want to do in their life. And I think one is respecting life. I think number one, not number one, but one of the issues. I think that a lot of our people, a lot of our kids have been let down, whether they've been arrested and gone through a juvenile system or the court system. There's no programs for rehabilitations in those programs, not enough. We need to do more there. We need to do a better job in reentry. I'm not saying all these kids go through that. We have to do more there. We have to create opportunities and express what opportunities really mean for young people. There's a whole lot of work to do. And I look around the country and, most major cities are dealing with the same thing. And, I don't think we spend enough time talking about how do we value life and how do we make sure young people feel wanted and cared for. And some of these folks aren't young. They're older. They're 30s and they're 40s. But we need a system that stops failing people. Now, some of you might commit the crime and they have to go serve their sentence. And okay, I can understand that. That's our judicial system. But while people are away, we have to do a better job of rehabilitating people. We can't just lock people up and expect that, they're going to come out and become model citizens. If we don't help people with the tools on how to become model citizens, whether that's through education or through anger management classes or a whole host of other classes, we have to do more of that on that side. If we truly want to address criminal justice in our country, it's also about creating opportunities for people. Whether they're in prison or even determined to prison instead of prison, another option, and we really have to look at that.
Let's talk about Project Opportunity, which you announced last week. It's a program, a pilot program, that's designed to deal with the long-term effects of a criminal record, a CORI, basically. Can you tell us about this pilot program?
Yeah, we have to look at CORIs as well. I mean, CORIs in a lot of ways limits people's ability to get employment. And quite honestly, when I was a legislator, I voted on the CORI reform legislation. I think it was 2010 that we passed that basically felony was 5-year look back. A misdemeanor was 5-year look back. Felony was 10-year look back. I think that we have some folks that are causing and creating crime or committing crime under the influence or in certain circumstances, and we really have to think about, are we going to hold that against them for the rest of their life? There are certain crimes that, pedophiles and sexual crimes, I think that stays on your record forever, in my opinion. But I think that when you talk about when you talk about some of these other crimes that people are doing, we need to create opportunities. So what we're doing in the city of Boston is trying to create pathways for folks to be able to have gainful employment and be able to help them move forward, move their family forward. Many people come out of prison, and after they're out for a little bit, they still can't find a job for CORI. Well, what do we expect them to do if they can't become a doctor? We know that. So if we don't address the issue of the CORI and people are wanting to better their life and better themselves and their family situation, we need to be partnering that work with them.
Just to clarify for listeners, CORI stands for C-O-R-I, which is an acronym for a report that employers usually do on a background check, which will show the criminal history of a particular employee, for example, or a volunteer. Let me just throw the number out, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You have taken some steps to address racial equity recently. We are in a national reckoning and a local reckoning with our history on race. Last month, you named Carolyn Crockett to a new cabinet position that you created, which was the chief of equity. What responsibilities will Carolyn Crockett have, and why did you feel that the right step was to create a position like that?
You know, we've been here in the city ever since I became mayor, focusing on equity in all of our policies and racial equity in all of our policies. And we had talked about for years of bringing a position to the cabinet. We have created and worked strengthening departments that were here in the city of Boston in the past. But we have to take our work even higher than it was. And I think what Carolyn brings to the table is an expertise and an understanding of the work that needs to be done. She has several departments under her, women's advancement, immigrant advancement, to name a few, to think about how do we move forward in those two areas. But also it's not a committee, but racial advancement and really thinking about what we heard in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder was a lot of people concerned about that racism is still very much front and center here in Boston, here in the Commonwealth, in the country, quite honestly, and hasn't been fully addressed. And Carolyn brings a unique perspective to the table to think about. She's been here for the beginning of her third week right now, so she's working on plans. I spent about a half hour with her today about how we move forward together, working through cross departments. So as we think about our work internally on equity, we need to look to the lens of equity for everything we do, from literally purchasing a pencil, to our work in housing, to our work in economic development, to our work in policing, to our work in all the different departments here in the city. And Carolyn's going
to... Let's go to the phones.
Yep.
No, go ahead. Finish that thought, please, and then we'll go to the phones, Mayor Walsh.
All right, let's
grab our first caller. We have Melissa, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Melissa on the line from Framingham. Melissa, you're a BU employee, is that correct? Melissa, do we have you there?
Can you hear me?
Hi, Melissa, go ahead. Yes.
Okay, yes, I'm a BU employee, and I just have a question about how the city is planning to handle the resumption of in-person learning at a lot of the universities and colleges that's slated to happen in the next month. I'm worried that with having lots of students coming in from hot spots all over the country and mingling with the population on the MBTA like they normally do, that it's really going to put the general population at a huge risk with this going on. So... Yeah.
Great question, Melissa. Thank you. Great comment as well. One of the things, I mean, I haven't been briefed in about a week on the college's plans, but I think it's their intention to quarantine everyone that comes on campus for 2 weeks and also test them for coronavirus and monitor their health as we move forward here. I think a lot of colleges, not all, but a lot of colleges are coming back early. Kids are coming, young people are coming back a couple weeks early so they can do this. It's something we're going to keep a very close eye on. I think some schools have made decisions not to come back in September. I think that the decision on coming back to school, whether it's colleges or even our own schools, is going to be very fluid up until probably right before school starts, because we're monitoring these numbers on a daily basis, and we're keeping a weekly track to see if we've seen any increases in coronavirus. And over the last 3 weeks, we saw two very minor increases, 1.9% week ending the 7th, 2.5% week ending the 13th, and then last week I think we went down to 2.2%. So we're monitoring literally the percentages every single day, but we're basically keeping a 7-day period and tracking the previous seven days and looking if we're seeing any trends happen here. For a while there, I was a little concerned. We had two positive weeks, and then we went back to having a negative week last week, which is a good sign. But your point is absolutely right. We're talking a lot of these states that these young people are coming from are from states that are hitting the surge right now. And obviously that was concerning not just to me, but I think it should be concerning to a lot of people. But the schools and colleges are planning on quarantining those that are opening and quarantining kids for a couple weeks.
Mayor Walsh, let's stay on schools and education for a minute. We've had a number of call-ins and discussions here on Radio Boston the last couple of weeks, representing kind of all the sides of people both feeling anxious and feeling ready about school starting in the fall. No matter what, it's going to be a huge challenge, whether it's in person, it's all online, or it's a hybrid. How are you thinking about Boston Public Schools reopening in the midst of this pandemic?
I actually have a meeting, another meeting today right after this call to talk about it. We're going to be hopefully talking, be able to talk more publicly about it in the next couple of days. You're right, it is a big challenge. People are all over the place on it, rightfully so. Some parents feel that they think that their children should not be in school learning in September. Some folks think we should be in school learning in September. I heard Randy Weingartner from the American Federation of Teachers, the president, national president, was on yesterday on CNN, and she was talking about how she feels that in certain places schools could open as long as the trends are in the right direction and we have the proper PPE, the proper cleaning, the proper everything to keep people safe. So it's going to be a very challenging, tricky time for us over the course of the next 50 days or so in order to make sure as we move forward and how we do it in a safe manner.
So I want to stay on schools for a minute, Mayor Walsh, and ask you about Superintendent Brenda Casilius. Two organizations, the Boston High School Heads Association and the K-8 Principal Association, sent feedback to her last week. I want to hit on a few points they raised. First, Casilius has planned to significantly change the structure of the system. According to her plan, by fall of 2021, 7 of the city's struggling open enrollment high schools undergo a big curriculum overhaul and expand to include 7th and 8th grade. The High School Heads Association letter claims that that's not realistic and that they were left out of the planning process. What's your response to those concerns?
Well, I mean, I think obviously they have concerns because they sent a letter. I think that, I talked to the superintendent. I know she was going to plan on meeting with the school heads, I think, over the weekend. But I'll address a couple of things in the letter. Number one, the K to 6, 7 to 8 model was voted on by the school committee in May of 2019. So that's something that there was conversations before Brenda was even the superintendent here in Boston. As far as overhauling high schools, it needs to happen. We need to make sure that, we just had a report by DESE that showed that some of our high schools are underperforming in a dangerous space as far as being potentially could be taken over by the state. We need to do some real transformation in our high schools, and I think we need to make sure that the leaders are partners with us, and any space that the leaders don't feel as a partner in this space, that's where Brenda and the school leaders need to get together and have conversations about making sure we can't improve our district if we're not on the same page.
So just one more question on this, because the other letter from the K-8 Principal Association included several pages of anonymous quotes. They are anonymous from Boston Public School teachers saying things like, quote, it feels chaotic and toxic to be working in BPS right now, or, quote, much of Dr. Kasilius's actions feel like they're fueled for publicity's sake, end quote. We know she's the fourth BPS superintendent in 6 years, and there seems to be a lingering lack of trust between school leaders and the district leadership over all of this change. How to address that deep-rooted cultural issue and rebuild that trust?
I mean, first and foremost, we got to put into context. For the last 4 months, we have not been in school. The district has been had to transform to a fully remote learning program. We've served over 1.2 million meals. We've had to purchase Chromebooks and deliver Chromebooks to our students. So there is a point of a lot of concern right now in education, not just here in Boston, but throughout the country. So I think we have to put that into context. I think as far as anonymous quotes, I think anonymous quotes, it's easy to put anonymous quote out there. I think if there are major concerns, the best way to do it is not necessarily by a letter, although letters here now, so you have to address it. But I think by having conversations, bringing it up in areas where you can make significant change. I think by saying Brenda is doing stunts, so I forget how you put it there, political stunts. I mean, I don't think that necessarily that's, I wouldn't say that's how she's operating the district. I think that she's come up with a structural plan to change our district. And then what happened was coronavirus came, and it's we're all in a very difficult time right now. And again, I think every time we talk publicly in a negative fashion about Boston Public Schools, it doesn't help our district, and I've said it in the past that we need to work behind the scenes at the table to improve our education. But by pointing out shortcomings, by sending anonymous letters, doesn't do that. I don't find it effective, and I don't find it a way to help Brenda's leadership. I don't to help Brenda's job that she has in front of her to improve the Boston Public Schools. The schools have been going through 40 years of anonymous letters and anonymous criticisms, and I think that, you know, Brenda came in here with a very clear plan to change the Boston Public Schools. And the reason for changing them is for the young people's education, to strengthen. So when young people go into BPS or kindergarten, they can graduate in 12th grade on a pathway to college or a pathway to a career.
Mayor Walsh, I want to go back to the phones because there's still a lot we want to cover in the limited time we have. 800-423-8255. We have Carol on the phone from Lancaster. Carol.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. My question was, when we see things like pictures of people in Chelsea waiting in long lines for food and underserved communities that have been really hard hit, what can the average citizen do to try to help ameliorate that situation? What kind of solutions are there for people to volunteer or to do something to end those kinds of things?
Thank you for that. It's been really complicated to get volunteers right now because of COVID. I think one of the things you can do is reach out to, like, the Greater Boston Food Bank. You can reach out to Project Bread or organizations like that to see how they can help. I know that in Boston ourselves, we've served, I believe, over between our school lunches and our adult lunches and meals. We've done over 2 million meals since COVID started. So when you think about that, the need is great. I think that that's one thing you could do as far as helping moving forward. And those folks that want to make investments or donations, certainly donating directly to the Greater Boston Food Bank or Project Bread. Food insecurity is a big issue, not just in Chelsea or in Boston, but in the country, a lot bigger than people understand and realize. And COVID has put a real big spotlight on that.
So, Mayor Walsh, I want to shift gears now. I have a few questions for you on policing that I'd like to be able to get to. I'm going to start by asking you about a story that WBUR published today regarding an approach used by police during last summer's what was called Operation Clean Sweep. The ACLU provided WBUR with several hours of police body and handheld camera footage from officers during the 2 days of that operation, and WBUR has spoken to a number of legal experts who say the police stops appear to be unconstitutional. The question at hand is whether officers had reasonable suspicion, which they need to stop people. The operation led to 34 arrests, 18 of which were for outstanding warrants rather than any sort of crime happening in the moment. I want to play just a short cut of one of those stops minutes after police blocked off Atkinson Street. This is an officer addressing the crowd on a bullhorn.
Not free to leave.
So Ruth Berkwin, a senior and managing attorney at the ACLU, said of those stops, quote, police have to have a reasonable and individualized suspicion that the person they're stopping has either committed a crime or is about to commit a crime. And there was none of that here. They simply decided to capture all the people in a full block on a street in the city of Boston, end quote. Do you have any concerns over how the police handled these stops?
Well, let me just stop by saying to your viewers, this was over 1 year ago. What the police did out there. So this is a story that's rehashed, which already been told many times. But in saying all that, what happened out there was we had an alarming increase of violent crimes in the New Market Square area last summer. The Boston Police Department increased their presence as a response to further prevent crimes. This is to protect people that were, whether they had substance use disorder or they had walking down the street. What we did in response to it, we created what was called the Plan Mask and Cast 2.0, striking the balance between ensuring public health and public safety and quality of life in the area and the surrounding neighborhoods. You know, I don't know if the lawyers from ACLU reached out to the people that live in that community, but certainly the residents were telling us that we needed to continue to prioritize those folks that were suffering from substance use disorder. Make investments in resources battling the opioid epidemic, the crime that was happening out there, the shooting up that was happening out there, the alleged other crimes that were happening out there, the drug dealing. So we were able to put a different focus on it and try and address the issue in a different way. During the COVID pandemic, the city has continued to offer resources. Again, it's, you know, I appreciate everyone saying that, you know, focusing on what happened last summer. But if anyone that would walk down the street there and saw it, there was a lot of people put in harm's way, including people that were sick and suffering from addiction on the sidewalk there.
So I'm just stating the facts. Yeah, I hear you on that. And I recognize this was a year ago, although it can be difficult and time-consuming to get arrest reports released, body cam video released, so it can take a while to come back around to these.
There was videos right after that incident. They were on TV. I saw them all, and there were stories written about certain things on that, and I saw that. But again, I'm going to say we're going to focus on taking care of the person that's sick and suffering out there. I mean, I think if you want to talk about addiction, you want to talk about substance use disorder, I'll talk about it all day. I mean, I think that's what we have to do, and that's what we've been focused on out there, in getting people into treatment and trying to help people that are out there sick and suffering, and then not being preyed on by drug addicts, by sexual predators, and everyone else, quite honestly. Drug dealers,
would you,
I should say.
Would you have concern if you found out about stops using this kind of approach now? Because the police are out there 24/7 responding on the streets right now.
They're out there because the community wants them. Let's be clear. The community. I had a meeting last week with the South End community, and we were talking about how do we address this issue in maybe a little different manner without having a police presence out there. And the Civic Association presidents were very upset with me, the fact even thinking about pulling back the police out there. So you might want to bring them on and talk to them about it.
And that's a fair challenge, and we will continue to talk to law enforcement. I also just want to note for the record that the ACLU had to sue to get this particular police footage. Crowd videos, which were out immediately, were different. I want to stay on policing for a minute, but I want to shift gears a little bit. I'm sure you're aware we've been seeing reports out of Portland, Oregon, that federal authorities there have been arresting protesters while not wearing any IDs or badges. The president and his administration have said on multiple occasions that they believe it's within the federal government's authority to send military or other federal authorities into cities and towns to enforce the law if they don't like the way that local authorities are doing it. You know, we've had run-ins in Boston with the president and his administration before. Are you concerned about this, and how are you thinking about it when it comes to Boston?
Yeah, I mean, I saw some of the stories in Portland. There was a young man that got picked up. He was detained for 3 hours and let go, and they didn't seem to have a reason for arresting him, and they didn't give him a reason for it. I'm not concerned about that happening in the city of Boston, but certainly we'll keep my eye on a situation like that. I think that, you know, certainly the president has put a lot of threats out there across the country over the last 3.5 years of his presidency. Some have he's followed through on, some he hasn't. You know, particularly one of the biggest concerns that we have here in Boston is they always talk about ICE raids and put a lot of families at fear. You know, it appears that, and I don't have all the stories out in Portland, Oregon, but the ones that I've seen have been unjustified completely. And I think that, you know, at very least, people should be identifying who they are. It was a pretty scary situation three federal agents approached the young person, just picked him up and threw him in the back of a van. They brought him to the U.S. Attorney's Office or the courthouse in Portland, and then I guess they let him go a few hours later. There was two reporters talking about it. It was on one of the national broadcasters watching. So certainly it seems to me very concerning. I don't think that... I'm not sure if the mayor of Portland, I don't think the mayor of Portland invited in the U.S. attorney, invited the federal government, I think it's Homeland Security. I don't think they invited them in either. So I think that if a city needs assistance, they should be asking for the assistance. And if the city doesn't ask for assistance, then I don't think there's any role for a federal agency to play.
All right, before I let you go, I got to ask. Friday night, as of right now, is opening night for the Red Sox. I'm a huge baseball fan. Kind of have mixed feelings, but definitely going to watch. Are you looking forward to that? Are you going to grill some hot dogs and watch the game?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, you know, I was watching, I think there's some preseason baseball on the other night. I watched a couple innings. It was nice to see sports. It's kind of strange without fans in the stands, though. But I'm looking forward to seeing at least something come back. I mean, you can only watch so much of Netflix or reruns. So I think it's seeing our sports come back would be nice to see it for a while. Hopefully they can stay healthy and safe while they do it.
All right. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, I know some of these are conversations are about difficult topics, and we appreciate your continued willingness to come on the air, join us to talk about them, take listener calls. Thanks for being here, and we look forward to speaking with you again next month.
All right. Thank you.
It is hot out there. That's because Boston is the middle of its first heat wave of the summer. Now, usually there are a lot of ways you can escape the heat, maybe turn on the AC, go to the mall or a community center or a pool. But for those who don't have air conditioning in their homes or can't afford to run it right now, this year is really hard because COVID-19 restrictions, physical distancing guidelines have limited where you can go to cool off. So what do we do? What do people do? And what are the social and health effects of trying to survive the heat while also trying to survive a pandemic? We're going to talk about that now. And here to help us have this discussion is Rebecca Davis, the Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Rebecca, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Rhianne Gibson, Senior Research Fellow at the Conservation Law Foundation, who manages their Healthy Neighborhoods initiative. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me this afternoon.
So heat happens every year, Rebecca and Rhianne, but this year is different because of COVID-19. What unique issues is it bringing up this year? Rebecca.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things that you mentioned in the opener. One is that a lot of our traditional cooling outlets for folks that don't have air conditioning at home, whether that be, you know, actual cooling centers, youth facilities, libraries, senior centers, or even just going to hang out at the mall, don't feel as safe with the pandemic and concerns, particularly for the most vulnerable. And at the same time, you know, we're seeing a lot of folks, they've lost their jobs, they have less income coming in. So even if they might have an air conditioning unit running at home, they're concerned about turning it on. They don't have the funding or the money available to pay their utility bills. And this is really highlighting what is an exacerbating situation, particularly as we look at climate change and increasing heat waves now and in the future.
So Rhianne, in the short term, what do we do?
In the short term, definitely we need plans that are community centered and very specific to the experience of the community in this time, unique time with COVID-19. Some communities are being hit really hard with COVID-19. So they've got family members who are in isolation. They're managing kids and on childcare and all of that. And some communities aren't being hit quite as hard. So the complications are different for each community. We definitely need more cooling centers that take into account some of these considerations where people may be exposed to COVID-19, but they also need a safe place to cool off. We need to be listening to more community voices and following the lead of the trusted community partners in each place to figure out what the unique concerns are for everyone and how to accommodate them.
I want to talk for a minute, both of you, about the elderly. Traditionally, they are the most vulnerable to heat. Our older adults are. They're also the most vulnerable to COVID. What are the unique risks facing older adults this summer at the intersection of this heat and COVID? And what are some of the options or resources specifically available for them?
Yeah, I think the
Rebecca
you
made,
put it out there
yeah, go ahead.
Elderly, particularly a unique situation. And also, we know that those that are most vulnerable to heat are those that are managing underlying medical conditions, and those are often the elderly, and similar with COVID. And so a lot of what we're seeing our cities and towns do is one, really try to partner with community-based organizations and even some of the mutual aid networks that have been set up to deal with the pandemic, to see whether we can also use that to deal with heat. So wellness checks are really important. I mean, one of the biggest things any of us can do as individuals is check in on our elderly neighbors and make sure that they're doing okay and surviving, and have, you know, the tools that they can to figure out how to stay cool at home.
Yeah,
Rebecca,
definitely.
Let's talk. Sorry, go ahead.
I would also add to that just the being mindful, of course, of the added risk for the elderly and the social network connections that are so important for those folks who aren't connected to smartphones or, you know, can't pull up their community and in their laptop and find the nearest cooling center in their community. So things like going door to door with flyers, door knocking, calling people up on their landlines to figure out, you know, what's going on and how they can, how the community can best serve them.
So let me ask both of you, because I've read some work by both of you. We're having a conversation that is real time, right? It's about the intersection of something that's happening right now, which is this heat wave, and something else that's happening right now, which is this pandemic. And yet we know that the type of heat, the structural dimensions of the environmental justice dimensions of the kind of heat that our most vulnerable neighborhoods in Boston are experiencing are the result of long-term budget decisions, disinvestment, lack of green space. Can we talk about kind of how we got here?
Yeah, I would start to echo what you said about the historical decisions we've made nationally in terms of who lives where, and centering communities of color, concentrating communities of color through redlining practices, through our national policies in communities where there's also a highway running through. Where there are power plants and other industrial buildings that are sending exhaust into the air, and where there are bus depots, are there more likely to be buses running through the community as opposed to a transit line or something like that that's not blowing out chemicals that are as detrimental?
Yeah, Rhianne is really right. It's these historical patterns of land use and historical patterns of investment, but it's even decisions we're making today. I mean, a lot of these communities have, you know, older housing stock that hasn't been invested in. And at the same time, you know, we're not producing the level of affordable housing or accessible housing that we really need to meet our community's needs. And so it's a history and of federal, state, and local policy, and it's also, you know, some of the land use decisions that we continue to make.
I want to play a little bit of sound here from a Chelsea resident that we spoke with earlier about what it's like to experience this heat. So the resident's name is Noemi Lobato Rosas, and she's speaking through a translator, Maria Belen Powers, from Green Roots, which is an environmental protection organization in Chelsea. Here's Noemi.
Este mes nos subió bastante. We're experiencing a lot of heat. I have a 4-year-old son. He sweats a lot. So we try to keep cool by taking a lot of showers and baths with cold water so that we don't have to turn on the AC at night. This past month, the bill went up by a lot. And, you know, with the hours that have been cut in our jobs, we're just trying to save energy. And we're trying to stay inside in order to stay safe from the virus. But yeah, our bills are going up by a lot.
I suspect that there are many for whom it didn't even occur to them that in this level of heat, if you have air conditioning, you might still not be able to run it because of the cost of the utility. I know when I was running Catholic Charities during the Great Recession, and one of the hardest things for us to do was get money to help people offset their utility bills. And yet those really are a matter of life and death. So what can we begin to do around city policy to address these immediate rate limiting factors to even cooling off or being safer in the home?
Well, You know, in the short term, I think, you know, we're really happy to see that there continues to be utility moratorium for shutoffs through the summer. And so, you know, anyone that's having trouble accessing their utility bills, you know, they should reach out and look to see whether they're eligible for assistance for discounts or payment plans. But I think we do need to do more on this front. There's a program called the LIHEAP program, and that's federal dollars that we use to help folks pay their bills in the winter when they have high heating costs. And one of the solutions we're looking for is trying to increase that funding and also have it be eligible for income eligible folks to utilize in the summer so that if they do have access to an air conditioning, they can use it and stay comfortable.
Rhianne, I know you've been thinking about this intersectionality, right, between Black and brown communities, low-income urban neighborhoods, particular vulnerability to heat. We've addressed some of the systemic issues there already, but as we begin to think very specifically in the coming months, how we support our communities that have been hardest hit by the pandemic and now by these exogenous factors that are also making them vulnerable, what kind of policy priorities do we need to have? I heard you on listening to residents, on being driven by local needs, but based on your research, what kind of policy priorities do we need to be thinking about?
I think we definitely need to be developing more plans, more resiliency plans, recognizing that these are two major crises that we're having that are overlapping, but climate change is ongoing. We're only going to see more climate crises moving forward. So developing resiliency plans like I said earlier, looking to communities, I think through our transit, thinking through our transit and transit justice, making sure that clean energy is running those trains and buses, that we're not continuing to perpetuate some of these same harms that we've already been causing.
And Rebecca, in our last minute or so, what about climate change and thinking about long-term climate change strategies and climate change policy and all of this?
Yeah, I'm hoping this is a moment that we can call on our state and federal lawmakers to really think about a sustainable, equitable, and climate-forward recovery. I mean, we actually have a real opportunity to take dollars and invest them in the most vulnerable communities to help have a better housing stock so they can withstand the heat or even the cold, and to create some of these investments, whether it be transit, access to public space, planting of trees. We know all of these help make our lives better and the lives of communities better, and they also help to mitigate and make us more resilient to climate change.
And that's Rebecca Davis, the Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Rhianne Gibson, Senior Research Fellow at the Conservation Law Foundation, who manages the Healthy Neighborhoods Study there. Rhianne, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We want to end today's show by marking the passing of a lion of the American Civil Rights Movement, Georgia Congressman John Lewis. Lewis died on Friday after a battle with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He was 80 years old. Lewis's life work was fighting for racial equity in America and the right for all Americans to vote. So much of his role in that fight has been remarkable, including that at 23 years old, he was the youngest speaker at the 1963 March on Washington.
Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
Years later, on Radio Boston in 2013, John Lewis recalled what he observed earlier that day.
And then we start walking down Constitution Avenue. We saw hundreds and thousands of people already marching. Now, we were supposed to be their leaders. It was almost like saying, there go my people. Let me catch up with them.
So here to reflect on this incredible legacy with us is Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael is also former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, and a friend of the show. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, it is particularly killing me that I'm listening to you over headphones instead of like sitting with you with a glass of iced tea where we can relax and really you know, have the conversation that this moment deserves. How are you thinking today about the loss of Congressman Lewis? And by the way, another civil rights leader, Reverend C.T. Vivian, who also passed away last Friday.
You know, I think this moment reminds me that for any of us who had a chance to study these civil rights giants in school, whether it was when you were young or in college, we feel like we've known them for a long time. And I tell people I met him way before I actually met him. And I'm just, I think the saddened part of, aside from losing him, and I think he was so courageous in those final few months of his life, I'm saddened by the fact that people just got to know him. Like, they're just learning about his activism, his decades of service. And I think that's what saddens me most, but I think I'm also encouraged by the fact this is going to drive people to learn about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee or the Freedom Rides. And I'm looking forward to that rich conversation born out of his activism.
Why are people just getting to know him now, Michael?
Yeah, you know, there's so much untapped history, right, in this country. And we don't know about the sacrifices of others. And we get the short two or three sentence lines in our history books, whatever people might know of the March on Washington. They don't know the back line to the March on Washington, the politics behind it, the challenges of Senator Kennedy, and then later with Lyndon Johnson. They don't know what led up to the Civil Rights Act. So there's a lot that people don't know that will even make you appreciate him more as, you know, truth catches up to history and as people sort of dig in and learn about his work and his upbringing. I think there's so much in his story. I share with people that, you know, he born in 1940. He was a little kid. He was 15, 16 with the Montgomery bus boycott. So he was in Alabama as a child of Alabama when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. He was inspired by that movement. And it gave birth to his activism that he would then take to Fisk University and then take the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So we need to know what drove him as we're starting to see young activists live out his legacy, walking in the streets, taking risks, being disruptive in a way that'll make this a better country.
And, you know, my understanding is one of the things that really struck you was the youth of his activism. You know, 23 years old, speaking at the March on Washington, only 2 years older when he was in Selma, being beaten by police. What was your reaction to the youth of his activism? And how do you think about it now?
Yes, just inspirational. You know, I was a student at McAllister College in St. Paul when my history professor introduced us to John Lewis and Julian Bond and Stokely Carmichael, later named Kwame Ture. And you almost, based on the introduction to these giants, you felt like you knew them. You knew their passions, you knew their politics. And he was one that really stuck with me. Because he was willing to take the risk. When he got on those buses and Freedom Rides, he knew that it could cost him his life. He knew that speaking up to injustice at that time could cause you to lose your life. I mean, there's no greater sacrifice. So though we have difficult conversations today, though we may lose our jobs if we challenge injustice, that's not the same as the risk he had when he got on those buses in the 1960s. That's not the same as when he marched across that bridge in Selma. And he has the scars to show for us. I think whenever we're feeling weary, overwhelmed, challenged, whenever we're feeling like there's a resistance to progress, we got to remember what he felt. And he left us with that message of we need to get in good trouble. And I think we need to adopt what good trouble is today.
Let's stay with that for a minute. I want to play some sound because we've heard a lot in the last couple of days about his humility and his selflessness, but his fearlessness is humbling to me. So we've been watching some videos of him walking resolute, leading this protest across the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Bloody Sunday in Selma, 65, March of that year. He was beaten by the state troopers so badly that day that he fractured his skull. Here he is reflecting on that day to CNN.
I thought over and over again, they're going to arrest us. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, tramping us with horses. I went down on my knees. My legs went out from under me. I thought I was going to die.
He was actually treated and tested for brain injuries at Mass General Hospital in 1965 after that incident. That is what he has termed good trouble. That is scary trouble. Where do people dig deep to find the will to stir up that kind of good trouble? And in this moment, what do people who say no trouble is good trouble?
Yeah, I think we have to remember the history, right? So when you think about the evolution of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that group of student activists from across the country, and John Lewis was in those founding members that got together at a college in North Carolina and decided to organize. They were already desegregating lunch counters. We got to remember that that came out of a passion to resist injustice. That is the John Lewis that was a young boy in his 20s challenging segregation. We have to remember that when he was participating in the March on Washington, he didn't agree with everything that Dr. King and the other architects, the Big Six, and that movement to organize the March on Washington. But he humbled himself in his negotiations with the other leaders like Dr. King, who were elders to him, and really compromised, and they gained respect for him. So there's a lesson in this for all of us. There's a lesson of resistance. There's a lesson of disruption. There's a lesson of compromise. And there's a lesson of persistence. How do you stay true to the mission? And he did throughout his lifetime. So I think there's so much rich lessons in his life for us. Now is time for us to go back and unpack his life and figure out how we can apply it today.
We've got about a minute left, Michael. Congressman John Lewis reflected on where our future leaders will emerge on Radio Boston in 2015. Here he is.
Leaders are not necessarily ordained, appointed. They grew out of a movement. They grew out of the struggle.
Michael, in our last minute or so, he's gone now. Who are the standard bearers that we look to now? Who's going to carry on this fight?
So there's so many. I remember having the congressman, when he was in town, meet with some of my young leaders in the NAACP Boston branch. About 30 young men and women sat with him over at the JFK Library, along with some other young people, and he shared his life lessons. I have no doubt you'll see those young people take that lesson, those lessons that he shared that day, and they'll show themselves on college campuses, in corporate offices, on the streets, and I'm sure they're on the streets right now. One of his proteges, and I should say one of his staffers, Michael Collins, who worked as his chief of staff, is a Bostonian. In all these years, if you ever see a picture of Congressman Lewis, you'll see Michael Collins standing right next to him. We got to hold Michael Collins because that's like family to him that he lost. He has a legacy of young people he's given birth to across the country and their activism, and they'll do great things.
Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Sorry for the loss, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.